Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the May 12th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Will, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, buddy. How are you?
I'm kind of busy.
I can imagine you are.
Things are really good, brother.
I love it. Optimism is not an option. It is a requirement. Hey, let's get right to it, shall we? I'm fascinated by Gavin Newsom in the news this week. He's still banging the drum and holding forth like a 2022 version of Father Coughlin. I think that's how you pronounce that guy's name. I should know. He was a Catholic in the 1930s who was particularly outrageous in his declarations on radio. But we've got Gavin Newsom talking an awful lot about abortion. And one of the big stories that came out this week was that he has offered tax breaks to companies in anti-abortion states. I only sent that to you this morning, David. So I apologize. It's just kind of
out there. No. I had already seen it when you sent it.
Oh, good. This is the headline, and it's from Sean Hubler. She is a longtime LA Times and Sacramento Bee editorial reporter and editorial writer and columnist, and she's now a New York Times reporter from California. Her headline is Newsom offers tax breaks for companies in anti-abortion states. And David, I think this is kind of a clarifying moment. It's going to I don't take this pronouncement very seriously. I doubt that a lot of companies in the states that he's targeting, particularly Texas and Florida, are going to be open to moving to California.
No. I disagree.
Oh, tell
I
me.
Think that as a business owner, every morning, Will, I wake up and I think, look, what is the best place for me to conduct business? Where are my clients? Where are my employees? Where can I hire good talent? Where do we want to live? Where do we want to be? Where could we get abortions? I just, you go through taxes, you go through regulation.
When you're recruiting,
easiest access to baby killing, like you cover all the bases.
When you're recruiting, do you have a lot of candidates say, so what's your policy on abortion in the state that we're operating? Does that come up a lot?
Usually an analyst will want to know what our technology is, what our pay package looks like. If we will cover, and by the way, it's not just abortion they're after, it's euthanasia. They want
the full suite of death.
Yeah, they're looking at taking out grandpa and grandma as well. And a lot of states don't allow that. And so if you want to compete in the job market, we're looking at kind of a trifecta package. We offer health, dental, and vision, and then we offer abortion, euthanasia, and infanticide.
I love it. And we're pro-death penalty no matter what.
I don't know why you and I are sitting there laughing. It's kind of disgusting.
Well, what else can we do?
The wisdom of this world is foolishness. Foolishness.
So Gavin Newsom, quite clearly, I think the smart money is on all of this as a play to get national headlines. Check this story in the New York Times. I'm sure if I dug farther today, I'd find many more stories like this of Newsom offering tax breaks to companies in anti-abortion states. He's particularly
Here's
trying to get...
Here's what you do. I'm sorry, Will. I'm interrupting. I apologize.
No. Go ahead.
You want to make your state a haven for abortion, and there's not enough people here to be able to get a lot of good abortions going because a lot of people have moved to non-abortion states because of taxes, regulation, crime, critical race, whatever the stuff is. So what you do is you make your state attractive for people to come, and then they will come to your state and they'll do their abortion in your state.
That's right.
If you will promise to teach their kids well, they will come to your state to kill their kids. I'm not going to treat this story seriously, no matter how hard you try to make me. This is disgusting. It is a level. This is always, always the sign of a moral decadent bottom. Is not the sin itself, but the celebration of the sin.
And this is what's remarkable, right? I mean, I have friends, conservative, liberal, other, who really are what you'd call pro-abortion. And what's striking to me is just the celebratory quality of that. We had Assemblywoman Mia Bonta pop up this week in the news also. She held a press conference, I believe it was yesterday, maybe it was Tuesday. She is, of course, the wife of Rob Bonta, our attorney general, who was elevated into his position of attorney general by Gavin Newsom when Alex Padilla went to Washington. So we lost an attorney general to D.C. He's our California senator. And we gained Rob Bonta. Rob Bonta moves up, his wife slots in. She holds a press conference and announces that at age 21, I think, while she was a student at Yale, she got an abortion. And fascinatingly, Rob Bonta was right there. She declared in this press conference that Rob Bonta was basically the only man who was allowed to really speak out on this issue because he held her hand through her abortion. She describes it in really interesting and kind of, I think really utilitarian.
I have a question. Is that a little offensive? That why does a woman need a man to hold her hand during an abortion? Like, I thought you even opening a door for a woman at a restaurant is now misogynistic, but why is a man holding her hand during an abortion? I would think that's anti-feminist, or am I being a smart aleck? I'm serious. Like, isn't this kind of wrong of the man to condescend and patronize her?
Well, I think she's saying that abortion is a kind of it's like Wednesday family home evening, that if you're going to get an abortion, it's good to have a partner who's all in on your decision to, as she put it, to own her own body. She did not mind loaning that body temporarily to someone. She doesn't say that Rob Bonta was the father of the child.
That's a real gentleman. He will hold her hand through an abortion of a child that another man created. That's real love.
Yeah.
Don't you even feel weird talking about this?
I do, because this is, I would argue, at best, the conversation about abortion is one that is really intimate. And I don't even know where to start, except that Gavin Newsom has, as with virtually every tragedy, I mean, we've talked at great length, and this will happen again in the summer. Wildfires will start. We're talking, you and I, David, as one hit Laguna Beach, Laguna Niguel, just yesterday. Long story short, a fire erupted in a very wealthy enclave of Laguna Niguel, which overlooks the Pacific in some places and is right next door to Laguna Beach, and this fire erupts. We can count on Gavin Newsom to stomp through the ashes and talk about climate change and how killing oil will save us all from wildfire. Meanwhile, he, of course, has mismanaged fires. We may get to that later. But he uses all tragedy as theater, or at least as a kind of a background for his national ambition. He wants to be the climate leader in the world. He wants to be the leading abortion provider in the United States and conceivably the world.
But you know what he doesn't want to be? He doesn't seem to want to be the energy and natural resources leader of the world. He doesn't seem to want to be the economic growth leader of the world. It's like, I'm all for narcissism, I guess, in our governors, because I take it for granted. It's uncommon that someone wants to be governor if they don't have an ego and a little bit of a narcissistic trend. But why not just channel that kind of vanity and that drive for some decency and good?
Well, because I think this really marks the difference. That's why I say this is kind of a clarifying moment. Instead of standing up for some sort of principle that is really pro-life, and when I say pro-life, I mean oil as well. I mean not killing babies. I mean promoting education that actually works for K-12 kids. You're right. Newsom has come down on the side of scarcity. There aren't enough natural resources. We're going to kill the planet. We have to kill babies to make more space for the rest of us. And again, I come back to Mia Bonta's statement, which is provocative and I guess kind of chilling in as I read it anyway. She talks, let me see if I can find this story. The headline in the Sacramento Bee is, "He Held My Hand. Bonta's Share Their Abortion Story, Push for California Reproductive Rights." She says, "I found out that I was pregnant." Again, she's 21. She's a Latina girl who grows up in the Bronx. She says she and her mother faced housing. This is the way the reporter puts it. They faced housing insecurity that forced them to move 13 times in 16 years. That's the housing insecurity is the kind of lefty code word for, you know, they had to move a lot. They were poor. And so she gets into Yale finally able to help her family achieve financial stability. That's what's on her mind when she decides to have an abortion. I found out I was pregnant, she said at the press conference. I had to weigh all of the decisions that came with that reality, and I chose to get an abortion. I chose to own my body. Mm. I chose to make a decision that would allow me to recognize the ending of the cycle of poverty in my family. And that strikes me as tragic that that's how she saw this, that it was either family stability and security or the life of this child she had conceived. And she made the decision she made. I'm less here to judge that decision than I am to judge the performance she has made out of that decision as somehow the only one that anybody could make. And that the governor has jumped on that same theme and said, like, somehow I just see this as kind of the ultimate showdown between progressive politics and the business world, between, you know, private and intimate acts, and the state's intervention on behalf of, I don't know, a small number of people. I'm just almost without words here, David, but I do think that what's fascinating here again is the theater that is being made out of this, both by the Bontas and by Gavin Newsom. You know, so kudos to him. He got the headlines he hoped for. It will bolster his base, perhaps. You know, there are some people who I can't imagine anybody having a doubt right now about Newsom's stand on this issue. But fair enough. You know, that's what his base wants. He gave it to him. But I think it may upset California businesses already strangled by the state. And fleeing the state to know that he's offering subsidies to companies outside the state if they'll just move back here.
I think if we can switch out of the morbidity of the immorality and move to the economics, it would be curious to know why he thinks tax breaks would incent anybody. I thought that the supply side thinking was flawed. And I'm curious why taxes, subsidies, incentives, why do those all of a sudden work when it comes to a social agenda? This is new information for me.
Well, explain more about that.
Well, we are told that reducing marginal tax rates does not create economic growth. We are told that deregulation does not incent behavior. We are told that there is a general need to provide a higher tax base that trumps some of what the small, medium, and large businesses may want. We are told that greed is an unacceptable motivator in corporate decision-making. But then it seems like all of a sudden he's operating as if he doesn't believe that, that he seems to think people do respond to incentives, that, like, you come back here, we'll give you a subsidy, and then you can have all the kind of abortion options you want and whatnot. But
yeah, I think what you're saying is what strikes me here, and that is that specifically the offer of a subsidy in the form of a tax break will have a salubrious effect on a business person's decision making to move back into the state. And I just wonder about, as you said, all these other businesses in California that labor under these very high taxes, these very complex regulations, looking at the fact that the governor is now turning outside the state. I there's a great quote in the New York Times story here. And that is, it comes from a spokeswoman for Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. He's seen, of course, as the target of this, as is Greg Abbott in Texas. And these are his two likely opponents in a kind of a primary general election environment for president in 2024. The spokeswoman wrote, "Florida doesn't restrict anyone's rights. Perhaps fewer businesses and residents would flee California if Governor Newsom would focus on tackling the problems plaguing his own state."
Yeah.
So I think DeSantis's spokesperson has it exactly right, that this is not likely to persuade people to come into the state as others are fleeing it, because business is treated so reprehensibly in the state.
Yeah.
All right. So there's the Bontas. Also, we found out that the Alcohol Beverage Control Agency here in California is going to go after a Roseville, that's up in Placer County. A restaurateur during COVID in 2020 refused to close. In Placer County, the DA, the sheriff, Local police, local authorities refused to implement the governor's COVID-era mandates in 2020. And in November, this guy particular, this guy's, his name is Matthew Oliver. He owns two or three restaurants in Placer. And he kept his restaurants open. He said, not because he needed to make money so much, but because he needed to keep his employees employed so they could continue to work and pay their bills, et cetera, and not become reliant on the state for their support.
Yeah.
So he kept the place open. He even held something called the Newsom Hour. It was kind of a happy hour sort of thing in his restaurants. And this so ticked off the ABC, which is chartered, mandated, tasked with enforcing alcohol. That's it. Comes out of the 1930s, of course, the whole goal being, hey, alcohol is legal. We need somebody to sort of manage the provision, the distribution and sale, the production of alcohol in California. But now they're using it as a political tool. You didn't engage in mandating Governor Newsom's mandates. And they have selected out this one organization, this one company in Placer to, they want to insist, they want to impose a 30-day shutdown of all of his restaurants today to make him pay for actions he took in November. And just two quick points. November, that same month of that same year, Newsom is dining out unmasked in a restaurant with the doors closed, with more than three family members of three families represented at this French Laundry restaurant. We all remember it.
Yeah,
and at the
sure.
same time, the ABC is not going after French Laundry for its failure to impose.
Well, not yet.
Not yet.
I mean, I assume that's coming. You know how that in the corporate litigation world, there's such thing as a class action lawsuit where if the infringement is, shall we say, voluminous enough and people have a common legal argument for a tort that they can unify together, receive class status, and then have a kind of singular trial with multiple plaintiffs for the purpose of simplicity in a court system, can they do that with criminality where they could sort of do a bull, like almost like a conspiracy charge, a terrorist conspiracy charge, where you get Placer, this restaurant, this guy's a lunatic opening up his bar, trying to do business, serving people voluntarily.
Can't have that.
But then bring French Laundry in, and then you know how you arrest the hooker and the John?
Yeah.
So are we going to arrest French Laundry and Newsom?
Yes. We must.
And then you get Placer County in there, too. And this is what's interesting. It's going to leave people in a really interesting this will break down political tribalism because people are going to have to say, I'm for all these guys getting arrested or I'm for none of them getting arrested. But you're not going to be able to say like French Laundry stays and Placer County doesn't or whatever. So I kind of like this idea of just like don't pick one restaurant. Let's get all of them. And I mean, throw the book. Throw the book at these people.
I love your thinking. We have a number of very sophisticated.
No, but when I say throw the book, that's not the end run, the sentencing.
No.
You got to do a perp walk.
Oh, I like that.
That's Governor the old Newsom. Giuliani thing back when he was at his first moment of maximum shaming of himself was when he was arresting innocent family people off of the floor of their offices to as a way of trying to coerce them into turning on Milken to give testimony. So the perp walk is when they'd like come and get all the cameras and TV and come arrest
yeah,
you
sure.
and pull you out in front of everyone. That you know right. That wasn't done much back in the day. Giuliani kind of started that thing as a tactic. I'd like to perp walk these restaurant owners
along with some of their clients.
Well, the Johns.
Yeah. The John in this case, Gavin Newsom, who went to...
Well, he's
to
one of the Johns.
Yeah, he is one.
If we said we're arresting you for being a John? And he says, how did you know about that? Like, he kind of misinterprets.
I love it. I do want to point out that Placer County had COVID rates, despite the fact that they did not impose the governor's mandates to his liking or to the ABC's liking. Placer County's COVID death rate was 31% lower than the state average, despite the fact that they imposed nothing. So, I like the idea. We have a number of sophisticated attorneys who listen to the show. I would invite any one of them to email me and just offer to take up this case, and we'll see what we can do to raise some cash to support that effort. I like it. So there was a great piece. I'll just put this in the show notes by George Skelton, talking about Newsom's attempt to attack fellow Democrats, because elsewhere in the news, he's really using the abortion case to just pound the hell out of his potential conservative opponents, of course, in 2024. But more narrowly, what George Skelton, who's one of the deans of California political reporting, writes in the LA Times, that Gavin Newsom was smart to attack fellow Democrats. You might remember his harsh rhetoric, the governor's, just a couple of days ago, that he took a real aggressive swipe at the rest of the Democratic Party. He wrote, and the governor said, "Where the hell's my party?" This comes after the leak of the draft decision in Roe. Newsom told a news conference last week, "Where the hell's my party? Why aren't we standing up more firmly? Republicans always do these culture wars. Where's the counteroffensive from the Democratic Party? Why aren't we waking up to that?" And of course, the answer to that is really quite simple. Democrats are also engaged in culture wars all the time, 100%. That's what it means to ask businesses in other states to move to California so they can have access to our wonderful, now free abortion providers. So Skelton, though, says it's really critical for the governor to sort of single himself out among all Democratic candidates by saying they're not good enough. Not only is it Republicans are bad, but that the Democratic Party itself has not stood up the way that this Democrat will. And so he's distinguishing himself from all other Democrats in this campaign. So, David, smart move on the governor's part, dumb move. Aside from what we may personally think about this, what do you think about Skelton's argument that this is really smart to distinguish himself from do-nothing Democrats?
I don't know. I mean, I assume you mean smart move politically, right?
Yes, that's all I mean.
Yeah, probably. Probably I agree. I think that there's some sense in which there are voters that need to see energy. No matter how bad the thing is, they want to see activity. I don't think it's true of the masses. And I don't think it's true of the party with the advantage. So like if you were to ask the same political tactic question about the Republicans in the House, I do tend to think Mitch McConnell is more right. That right now, politically, just in terms of getting elected, playing a four corners offense is probably a little safer because of just the incredible gift of self-destruction the Democrats are giving. But I don't agree that playing that way politically in a campaign trail, it should mean that you actually don't have an agenda. I do think they should get in with a real agenda and do things and so forth and so on. But when you're talking about Democrat governor, political aspirations, this, that, and the other, I think there's something to be said right now for looking like you're getting something done.
Now, can you and I agree right here that in some future episode, perhaps as early as next week, you and I will discuss candidates, ballot stuff, because, you know, we just haven't got time today, but...
Oh, yeah, we need to do that soon because the absentees have gone out.
They're already here, yeah.
And our listeners are relying upon us to tell them how to vote. And so let's do that next week.
I'd love it.
Special ballot edition.
Let's do it. I'll just point to one candidate for the moment, and that's Michael Schellenberger, the San Francisco, I would argue, the San Francisco public intellectual, a guy who has written great investigative journalism pieces, he was a Democrat. He's now an independent. He's running for governor. And you'll notice that the governor has not said peep about Schellenberger, who I would regard as probably the most dangerous candidate from his left or from the center. The governor would much rather have this be a Republican versus Democrat kind of campaign. And in that, he's not going to mention Brian Daly, a state senator who is sort of the highest profile Republican candidate running against him. But Schellenberger, great piece in the Wall Street Journal. I'll post it in the show notes. Can Michael Schellenberger beat Gavin Newsom? The money's not even close. And Schellenberger rarely rates a mention in mainstream media, you know, the Sacramento Bee or the LA Times. They rarely mention the guy for obvious reasons. He is an effective foil, I think. He is the only effective, real effective opposition to Newsom from the center left. Great piece in the Wall Street Journal. I'll pop that in the show notes. Can we just move through real fast some updates, David, here? You and I have talked about a bunch of these items before. We don't need to drill into them again, but just so that...
Speaking of drill into them.
Booyah! Mike Tyson and the guy he repeatedly punched on a JetBlue flight that was getting ready to fly out of San Francisco April 20th. Mike Tyson punched the dude a bunch of times after the man reportedly threw a water bottle at him. I don't think that's just reportedly. That's what the story here says.
But it is reportedly. It's being reported right now from us for the first time, because when you and I did this story right after it happened, I don't think we knew about him throwing the water bottle yet.
I think we mentioned it. It was in the original. Yeah, I believe so. It was a small thing. He just, you know, he
threw. No, it isn't a small thing. It's one of the reasons that they're not pressing the charges.
You've
got it. The argument is you throw a water bottle at one guy. Let's take two people of the same size.
Right.
And same, shall we say, physical
fitness.
Expectations. One guy throws a water bottle, another guy throws a punch. I don't think that the second guy can be perceived to have been more aggressive. The only reason why we're having a talk about whether or not a guy who has a water bottle thrown at him is allowed to throw a punch is because the guy was Mike Tyson.
That's right. And the
I've thrown water bottles at hundreds of people. And nobody has ever even acted as if it were. No, listen, this guy, did you see the story, Will? This guy asked for the charges to be dropped.
Yes. The victim. Yeah, and you know, he was apparently drunk on the flight, and he's
apparently,
not even named.
He was hammered. He was, like, completely blacked out.
Yes, and I think he probably, you know, regrets for a whole bunch of reasons.
About 9 reasons by my count.
Did you count every?
Right, left. He's lucky, but Tyson clearly was holding back. You would think he could have just torn this guy's head off. We don't have to keep – look. The judge did the right thing. They dropped the charges.
It was the DA. Yeah, the DA just said he's not going to file charges.
Right.
He's not going to file charges because, quote, the conduct of the victim leading up to the incident, the interaction between Mr. Tyson and the victim, as well as requests of both the victim and Mr. Tyson, neither wanted the man to go to court. Neither wanted to go to court over the incident. San Mateo DA Stephen Wagstaff. I think this is one of those great moments where the law is actually pretty smart. You got two people. He doesn't need to get in. He's not trying to use the DA's not trying to use this as a stage for his own political ambitions. He said, yeah, there's really nothing to see here. This thing was resolved. You texted me the story about Rivian, the Irvine based car company, electric vehicle company. It's a startup. It was kind of the electric vehicle darling. It was going to take on Tesla. David, I don't really understand the stock news here because there's some sort of trigger, a deadline by which major holders in this electric vehicle company, which include Ford and Amazon and others, there was some date by which they had to do something with their holdings. And...
No, not where they had to. That's
Thank
not
you.
True.
Okay,
where they
me.
Could.
Where they could. Okay.
So you have a lockup window when you're an insider and you're not allowed to sell for 6 months. After 6 months, there's no law that says you have to sell.
6 months after what?
It
was the
IPO.
Okay, the initial public offering. Got it. Okay, so Ford decides to bail out. The stock starts to...
The stock was down 70% before Ford ever sold a share.
Correct. I was just going to go over those numbers. The stock price hits in November $172 a share. By the end of the year, that is December 31st, is down to $103 off $172, tumbling farther in the first quarter of this year to $50. So again, its high point is $172 in November. It's down to $50 a share.
And this then sounds almost as bad as Devin Nunez's spat. God.
Do you want to footnote that immediately and tell us what the reference is to?
He's the CEO of Trump's social media deal.
Yeah, Truth Social. And then it's down to Rivian's down to $22 this week. What's going on there? Why are companies bailing on Rivian, do you suppose, David?
Piece of crap.
In short, okay, this is the technical analysis from an economist.
It's not about Rivian. All electric vehicle companies that are not real companies have gotten killed, and all companies, electric vehicle or otherwise, that are what we call at my firm shiny objects. So, you know, Peloton is down 92% and Zoom is down 80%. And so companies that don't make money and don't have a real viable revenue model. And so there was just a lot of sensationalistic hype on a lot of companies. They were actually brilliant. And when they went to public markets, they were able to transfer the risk of their equity to other people, which is what, those people voluntarily chose to do, exchanging capital markets. I'm sure someone who bought the IPO at 80 and then went to 180 felt really smart. Now it's sitting down at 20, and you know, you kind of see what happens at this point. Companies no longer under the prestige of insane hype and irrational exuberance now have to either execute or not execute. And once again, this belief that this time it's different, you no longer need the silly thing called earning money in the new economy, has been proven to be disastrous. And so it won't be the last time. Human nature is a very, very failed investor.
Coming out of San Francisco, we've got a new poll by the San Francisco Standard. Their poll shows a headline here, D.A. Cheza Boudin faces grim odds in his recall election. With less than a month until the final day to vote in the June primary, the San Francisco Standard voter poll, I'm quoting from the story, found that over half of registered voters support recalling their district attorney, while less than a quarter plan to reject the recall. San Francisco voters in that poll said that what's really important in their city is these things. The homelessness is a problem. They don't like that. They feel less safe since 2019. They support arresting those who commit even minor property crimes like shoplifting and car break-ins. 66% of them favor forcing drug users into treatment. Policing is the number one thing on their minds, and they are now heavily in favor of recalling Cheza Boudin. Any thoughts about that before I point out that Cheza Boudin has announced a massive investigation, and it really is like a thriller, this is really a very interesting story. And set aside whatever you think of Cheza Boudin and the DA's office and crime and punishment in San Francisco, Boudin's office apparently launched this project, Autopilot, they call it, and it was to stem the just surge in car break-ins in San Francisco. So what they did was they put out decoy cars in high-crime areas, and they left bags of electronics in those cars. It might look like they were, you know, belonged to some normal human being or a tourist or whatever. And they put tracking devices on each of these electronic items and found out that all of these things were, many of these items were heading into a boba shop in San Francisco and from there being sold all over the world. So they were tracking these things into Europe, these stolen items, Europe, Asia, you name it. A boba shop in San Francisco turns out to be sort of the linchpin of this international, this global effort. It's really fascinating. Operation Autopilot, I'll put the story in the show notes, but it the timing is interesting. I think it's an attempt on Boudin's part to show that, you know, he's really on top of this and he's cracked this international crime syndicate, all coming out of San Francisco. My reading of this was, you know, that San Francisco ought to have done something sooner. I don't just blame Boudin. This is a, you know, a years-long slide into not just mediocrity, but violence as revealed in this poll.
My favorite part of the article you sent me in the San Francisco Gate about the Boudin recall was his people saying that this is just simply a byproduct of millions of dollars being spent by California billionaire Republicans to damage him. And then it says that the number one reason for the people supporting the recall is homelessness. And I was just wondering how many homeless billionaires, and how many middle class billionaires there are that are the ones that are actually kind of concerned about the homeless problem. I do know what billionaires do about homelessness. They generally are not really super affected by it. They have a way.
They have a home.
They have a way of being, shall we say, geographically immune from some of that. But, you know, you and I made this point, and I will, as harshly as I can, criticize our fellow Republican friends who believe that the sole reason, and it is one reason, but it is not the sole reason to hold up homelessness as a political wedge issue because of how it affects those of us who are not homeless. My argument and your argument has always been that one, there are two people damaged by homelessness in a society, and that is the people who have homes who then are dealing with some of the collateral damage of drug abuse, of lack of safety, of indecent exposure, of potential health, sanitation, hygiene, nuisances with their children, safety. I take all of that seriously. But unfortunately, when Republicans get really fired up and go to speak about that issue alone, they have a way of coming off, shall we say, a little snooty and a little self-serving, which I'm all for their concern here. But I would point out that another person who deserves a better policy response than the way San Francisco and Los Angeles have handled homelessness are the homeless, who perhaps need to be allowed an encounter with our friend Jim Palmer in the Orange County Rescue Mission and people that actually respect the dignity of human beings. The political response that it is a good thing for the people to be homeless and we should allow it and facilitate it and give drug needles to it, they are not only doing an unfair thing to the families that are nuisanced by it, understandably so, they're doing an undignified thing to the homeless themselves. And Chase Boudin is going to get recalled, and he is one of the worst district attorneys who has ever served office in our country.
And that's saying a lot. We've got George Gascon facing similar rumblings down here in L.A. County. It's absolutely fascinating. But, you know, the interesting thing here is I think you're right. We've addressed this so much. I don't want to really flog the dead horse here. But the problem of housing supply is also so critical in California. So when the governor is out there telling people move here for an abortion, he ought to also be telling them you may find it very difficult to recruit people to your company because housing is in such short supply. The cost of housing, the cost of simply living in California is higher than anywhere else in the United States. And that's a government-made problem. That is not a problem of the business community or the climate change or anything else that the governor would like to point to or Chase Boudin and San Francisco's political elite. The problem is that we've simply shut down the ability of people. We've limited the ability of people at the lowest level to grab that first rung in the housing fight. You know, they can't even get off the street or out of their cars or out of an apartment where they've, you know, trying to raise a family. Because we simply don't produce enough housing here. And we've talked at great length about that tonight. I don't mean to go through that again. Let's move on really quickly to just a couple more stories here. Great story that came out in the City Journal. That's from the Manhattan Institute. And that shows that public sector union membership is indeed slowly shrinking. The big call out here to California Policy Center for our work on researching this and helping people get out of their unions in that story. They refer to us among three other organizations for our, they single us out for our heroic work in filing thousands of Public Records Act requests to secure the data that shows that, in fact, union membership is shrinking. David, thank you for your support on that. You know what I'm talking about. Great story from a mutual friend of ours, David, Kenan Spivak, Southern California, I think L.A. attorney and sometime writer in National Review. Great piece here that I have held now for weeks, but it's important to point out because you and I talked about this for 2 years now. California court holds board diversity law unconstitutional. Kenan is reporting here on California's law that requires California headquartered companies to diversify their boards by selecting underrepresented community representatives on their boards. So you're talking here about LGBTQ stuff. A separate state law required, quote unquote, self-identified women to be appointed to these boards. That's still being litigated. But in this first case, the judge came out and just said, look, here's Kenan's piece. In a detailed and carefully reasoned 24-page order, State Judge Terry A. Green observed that when he asked the state why these groups, LGBTQ, were protected and other minorities, including religious minorities, were not, the state responded, quote, in effect, the included groups were included simply because they asked to be. Excluded groups were excluded because they didn't show up, that is, ask to be included. So he says this attempt to diversify corporate boards in California violates the Equal Protection Clause of the California Constitution on its face. That's there are two cases called Crest v. Padilla. That's a company that sued with the help of the Institute for Justice. I'm sorry, this is Judicial Watch, rather. I apologize. It was filed on behalf of three California taxpayers to prevent the state from enforcing this new law to include underrepresented communities. David, any thoughts on that before we move on?
No. You got a lot on the agenda. I'll let you move it on.
All right. We've talked a lot about wildfires. I just mentioned them a moment ago. An auditor's report shows that, I'm just going to make this super short. The headline here is Auditor Blasts California Regulators Who Oversee Wildfire Safety at PG&E. The way that Dale Kassler of the Sacramento Bee reports this story would suggest that, in fact, gosh, these regulators just let these evil utility companies sneak by and not produce really viable plans to mitigate against fires started by utility company power lines. It would suggest these companies are just kind of like, you know, doing whatever the hell they want out there. The fact is, you and I've talked about this, the Public Utilities Commission almost entirely runs and determines where investments can be made by California utilities, whether it's Pacific Gas and Electric, SoCal Gas and Electric, or San Diego. It's absolutely fascinating to read the auditor's analysis, however, because it really does show that the PUC, which manages these companies, has failed to determine that fire safety is a real priority for them. What they should be doing, of course, is playing in the space of generating more electricity from things that won't generate sustainable electricity. So while our state government is insisting that all of our utilities invest so much of their cash, their capital, their resources in renewable energy, they are letting them slide on the high cost of really hardening their utility infrastructure, and that leads to more wildfires. So again, a state inflicted, this is where government creates the problem. These utilities might be all in on renewable energy, but they would also recognize that every time they get sued for billions of dollars for sparking a wildfire, they got to do something to mitigate that, but they can't because the state priorities are different. They are aligned around climate change, not wildfire safety. I'm going to move here very quickly, David, to a story about this was kind of one of those tale of two headlines sorts of things. We've got a story that appears. Here's how Bloomberg reported the story. The headline is California's all renewable moment shows the future of the power grid. So one day last month, April 30th, California actually hit nearly 100% of the state's electricity needs for just a moment through solar, wind, and other renewables. Interestingly, hydroelectric and nuclear are included in these renewables, these renewable figures. but in any case, we had this brief shining moment where California actually got all of its stuff from wind and solar. That's kind of the headline. Dig deeper. It's not quite true. But in fact, it really kind of reveals that the power grid is only able periodically during low use moments and on very, very sunny and windy days, it's able to produce the kind of electricity that really wants to rely on entirely by 2045. And yet at the same time, there are increasing warnings that electricity shortages are growing across the U.S. as power grid operators shift to electricity from natural gas, coal, or whatever else they're burning right now at huge numbers. I mean, I think natural gas provides more than half of all electricity in California. Coal, imported energy generated by coal, still a significant part of this. But we've got at the same
and
time...
Coal, and coal's going higher as natural gas prices have gone higher. Coal becomes more necessary.
Yeah, so the
more
market...
competitive.
Yes, absolutely. So we're still really reliant on these fossil fuels, but the state government is trying to pretend that we're not. And a great story in the Wall Street Journal, the electricity shortage warnings grow across the U.S. Power grid operators caution electricity supplies aren't keeping up with demand in this transition to, quote, cleaner forms of energy. We've talked about that. So here's the chief operating officer of the California Independent System Operator. That's the agency that manages the state's power grid. He says, we need to make sure we have sufficient new resources in place and operational before we let some of these retirements go. Now, retirements are nuclear power plants, gas-powered electricity generation. And he's sort of like trying to warn in the most politically cautious way possible. We're not there. We are just shutting down. We shut down San Onofre. There was a plan to shut down Mount Diablo, Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor. Michael Schellenberger, the aforementioned gubernatorial candidate, is a very, you know, he's an environmentalist who's pro nukes. but we've got these two competing kinds of scenarios where the press wants to jump on this moment. This story about this one brief shining moment on April 30th, when literally for a moment, it was almost like watching the Wright brothers just kind of get off the sand at Kitty Hawk. Except that in this case, it seems we are headed straight off a cliff, to mix my metaphors.
Yeah, and you notice too that article that you sent about this all renewable moment is from Bloomberg.
Yes.
And they do, unlike the Wall Street Journal, generally have a little bit more agendized and Pollyannish wishful thinking approach to journalism around renewables. I would not say that the Journal comes out as big fossil warriors, but they certainly write more like grownups about the reality of the energy position. But I appreciate Bloomberg saying that running a clean grid 24 hours a day, 365 days a year is going to be maybe more complicated than people think. But the notion that there is anywhere near the capacity to even be dialoguing about renewables running the electricity grid for a sustainable period of time to the point where we can begin cutting investment in fossil is so juvenile and unhelpful and counterproductive. And I want to continue making this argument as a stewardship-minded fiscal conservative. It's totally unnecessary for us to claim that fossils that we do not desire a cleaner emission. Okay. My point is cutting off investment into fossil when renewables will be inadequate will assure a dirtier pollution of the environment and a worse emission of carbon. So there is no reason for us to not realistically assess where renewables can go and then do this thing that they've been doing in economics since the days of cavemen, called allocation of resources. And what that will do is move the needle substantially to cleaner emission from fossil fuel producers, while at the same time allowing economic incentive that doesn't cause people to starve to death or poorer people to have to pay $6.50 a gallon to try to get to work. So I do not understand for the life of me the framing of this discussion from the left. But all things being equal, these two articles you sent me, I would say that the Journal has been a better reliable source than Bloomberg has on this subject.
Well, I hate to keep coming back to this, or I don't, but Gavin Newsom's attempt to lure companies in comes at a time when this is what's going on. Our energy prices are spiking. We have the highest gasoline prices in the country. We have the highest electricity bills in the country. So I guess, I don't know, come for the abortions, stay for the high taxes and regulation. If you're a working class person in California, if you really, you know, you just don't have a whole lot of excess bandwidth in the income and expenses ledger, these things make life really difficult. And yet these are the very people, this is a government that flies under the flag of social justice, even as it destroys, erodes life in working class communities. I really wish that our Republican friends would constantly preach, you know, that that's the thing that Californians are, I think, being led astray on. We are being suborned by this argument that somehow all of this pain that we're inflicting on Californians is good for us. And we really miss the impact on the poor. You and I've talked at great length, too great a length, about public education and how lousy it is in California. This is, you know, we pretend to be concerned about our poor kids by continuing to reinvest in a system that undereducates them, fails systematically for 40 years. This is the nature of the state. And so for that reason, we've got this great story that just came out a couple of days ago. The California State Department of Finance says for the second straight year, California will see has seen a population decline. 2020 was about 185,000 lost. We lost 117,000, slightly down from the year before in 2021. So this is the first time in more than a century that California's population has declined, not just one year, but now two. And what's really interesting is if you read, again, our friends at the New York Times, if you read their take on this, here's the lead graph from their story on the population decline. Well, you can attribute it to deaths from COVID, aging baby boomers, fewer children, and restrictions on immigration. And then in a kind of a side note, it says these factors, not to mention the soaring cost of living. It's like, not to mention the atomic bomb, not to mention, I don't know, a land war in Asia. These are the cost of living is everything. How do I know this? Because deaths from COVID occurred all across the country. And even in those states like Texas and Florida, which the governor just constantly maligns, the deaths from COVID were marginally higher in Florida, for instance. So deaths from, but their population increased in the same year. Florida's population increased despite COVID deaths, despite aging. I mean, my gosh, aging baby boomers, please. Baby boomers age everywhere until they don't, and then we just call them dead. Am I right? I mean, like, age it, please. Fewer children. Family formation is harder in California for all the reasons we've been discussing here. Restrictions on immigration, really? This is what California relies on more than Texas, more than Florida. We rely on immigration, please. These are not, in other words, salient features of California's uniqueness. But the high cost of living is. That's the one thing. And the New York Times shuffles that to a, oh, yeah, that and also this other thing, not to mention it. Yeah, you ought to mention it. That's really the reason we are seeing a population decline here.
Well, you're exactly right. I think we talk about it every week. It doesn't strike me. I don't know. Every time we talk about it, I almost feel guilty because I just don't feel like we're even saying anything profound. It's so obvious. It's so intuitive. But it becomes much less obvious and intuitive for the bad guys.
Yeah. So in the middle of this population decline, the housing shortage we've discussed, we've got a California legislative leader, a lawmaker who is proposing, this is Toni Atkins, who's a Democratic state Senate. She's the Democratic state Senate leader. She's from San Diego. Toni Atkins is. Yesterday, she unveiled a proposal to create a revolving fund of $10 billion to help families buy homes. So David, you've got limited, stagnant housing supply, high market costs for housing, and you're going to pour $10 billion into the demand side. What's the outcome of that policy?
Well, it depends. There's a lot of factors that go in. What do you mean particularly? What outcome?
Well, it seems to me that this is, you're the inflation expert, but it seems to me if you've got a stagnant supply of something and you increase the capacity of people on the demand side to spend more, housing prices will simply be bid up. Isn't that a kind of a likely outcome?
Yes, it is. When you have lower supply and higher demand, it pushes prices higher. The other ingredients that enter the fray are incentives to build, and cost of capital, and regulatory environment, and overall economic health that produces the income and wages necessary to buy a home. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. The number one reason that I expect house price deflation is because of how ridiculously expensive prices already are. And I do not say that as a good thing. I think that you cannot have the lowest cost of capital as we had in 21 in human history, and at the same exact time have the least amount of affordability. The better way to say it is the highest unaffordability. Those two things are supposed to be inversely related. That when you have a low cost of capital, you have higher affordability, and a high cost of capital, lower affordability. Prices were bid up so much by the artificial low cost of capital and the artificial low supply. And by artificial, I mean it's regulatorily induced. It need not be so low. Some of it was, you know, home builders were beaten up back, you know, 10 years ago after financial crisis. But the fact of the matter is that we've been able to get a lot of new supply and housing stock built in other parts of the country. And so on the surface, you're dealing with a supply-demand imbalance. And that pushes affordability issues higher. To the extent that house prices come down, it will be a much needed correction to a bubble that they created that was entirely avoidable.
Yeah, I just, for me, this comes back to maybe the theme of this episode, and that is that virtually everything proposed by the Democratic supermajority in Sacramento and approved by our governor is supposed to make life better for the poor, and this will almost certainly, I think, make it worse. Yes, a few people may actually win in the short term by this, but pouring $10 billion into a limited housing market seems to me a recipe for disaster. And Tony,
if you want more of something, if you want higher, listen, I just want to leave it at this because I've already said my piece. Subsidies, no, the very best case for subsidies is that they still do damage. All we're debating about is how much damage and who hurts first.
Yeah. Yeah. David, I think that's all that we have time for today. You?
Well, I know it's all we have time for, but, you put together a lot of categories, a lot of links here, and I just hope listeners understand how much work you put into preparing for this.
It's the scaffolding that they don't really care about, I'm sure.
I'm looking through your email right now, and I just want listeners to know that I think I may not have clicked on all the stories today, but I think we covered 13 of your stories. And there's like 27 more that we didn't.
There's so much good stuff. It's like every one of these categories that I sent you this morning, David, each one of these could just be an episode by itself. Here's what you're not getting today. We're not going to talk about the dire straits, situation around our schools, the fact that Tony Thurmond is the guy in charge of that and has, you know, basically just been gifted hundreds of thousands, almost millions of dollars. Well, in fact, millions of dollars now by government unions so that he can continue wrecking public schools and attacking charters, the one real kind of school choice we've got where there's state subsidized education. Sacramento students are going to be left in the classes until late June because of a teacher strike. The principal of Lowell High School in San Francisco walked away from his job, just saying like the San Francisco Board of Education is so corrupt, so dumb in what they've done to this amazing, this monument to merit-based applications in one of the state's premier high schools. He just walked away. San Diego's largest high school, Patrick Henry High, cut all honors courses without talking to parents. I could go on. There's simply so much out here.
Ironic namesake. You know, give me liberty or give me death, but don't give me honors classes.
That's right. All right, that's all the time we have today. You can find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and rate and review the show. Listen to this, man. Rate and review the show. Turn your friends onto it. David and I are launching a massive marketing campaign that will bring in thousands of more people just like you. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions. Thanks to those of you who do that every week. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall. Hey, boys, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.